Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. The first thing I want to discuss, and I know it's on a few people's mind, we're at December 11th, 2018, and we're talking about the Fields verdict. I just want to briefly mention it. But this is now the third or fourth absolutely outrageous verdict that we've had to suffer. It couldn't be clearer that Mr. Fields had no intention of hurting anybody, but certainly that the left that showed up to Charlottesville that day did. I can show you where they said they were going to kill us, where they were going to, you know, whether it be beat us to death or whatever they were going to, whatever they were going to do. The injuries that they inflicted on us and have been doing for many, many decades now. That wasn't taken into consideration, the fact that he only hit them at 23 miles an hour, I believe it was. That Heather Heyer died of a heart attack. She was not hit by a car. And most of all, that crowd was defying a state of emergency order. And absolutely no right to be there. But they were permitted to terrorize the town without any check whatsoever. If he wanted to hurt them, he would have floored that thing and hit them at 65 miles an hour. So I don't know what to say, except that if any of our people are on the dock, there really is very little hope. Unlike some of the other cases, the defense here was very spirited. The defense was competent. And as far as I can see, it was an airtight case. There was no question that this woman didn't die. And this woman actually, you know, there's a video of her attacking people. They were trying to rip out the windshield of the car. All of this, you know, when you have a guilty verdict, even though you have video showing the opposite is true, you have a problem. Now, either it was because of simple brainwashing, this was a Charlottesville jury, or they planted people on it. I'm not sure which it is, but no normal person can understand the context here. Watch the videos. I've seen pictures of the impact, and Heyer is nowhere near it. She's at least two or three deep. So, I mean, we've always talked about, you know, the regime being simply a pillar of the left. But now here we have, yet again, hard evidence. And whether it be the Ramos trial or any of these others, I could even mention Edgar Steele, which really frightened me many years ago. This is the world we live in. We need to adjust our thinking accordingly. And in the spirit of these recent trials, I want to talk today about the 1960s, the Vietnam era. My point being, of course, the extreme double standard that the media and the political establishment employ. The hippies and anti-war movement of the 1960s were extremely violent. And yet there was no call for any Department of Homeland Security. There was no national soul searching. And no matter how many bombs these people set off, no matter how many ROTC centers they burnt to the ground, leftist ideology was never discredited. And so watch the double standard unfold between non-existent nationalist right-wing violence and blatantly obvious and extreme leftist violence. It should really get you extremely angry. Let me quote from Time Magazine from 2016. It may be hard to recall now, but there was a time when most Americans were decidedly more blasé about bombing attacks. This was during the 1970s, when protest bombings in America were commonplace, especially in hard-hit cities like New York, Chicago, San Francisco. Nearly a dozen radical underground groups, dimly remembered outfits like the Weather Underground, the New World Liberation Front, or the Symbionese Liberation Army, set off hundreds of bombs during that decade. So many, in fact, that many people all but accepted them as a part of daily life. As one woman sniffed to a New York Post reporter after an attack by a Puerto Rican independence group in 77, "Oh, another bombing? Who's it this time?" Hard to recall? It's hard because Time won't talk about it. This has been a deliberate policy for over 40 years. The fact that hippies are, to this day, romanticized as peaceful, despite being extremely violent, shows the level, the double standard, beyond comprehension. The Puerto Rican movement and the Jewish Defense League were the most violent so-called American terrorist groups of the 20th century. A guy by the name of Sam Melville set off over 100 bombs between August and November of 1969 in Manhattan. Have you ever heard of him? Time continues in this same article. Weather's attacks, and they're referring to the Weather Underground, began 3 months later, and by 1971, protest bombings had spread across the country. In a single 18-month period, during 1971 and 1972, the FBI counted an amazing 2,500 bombings on American soil, almost five a day. Because they were typically detonated late at night, few caused serious injury, leading to a kind of grudging public acceptance. The deadliest underground attack of the decade killed four people, the January 75 bombing of the Wall Street restaurant. News accounts rarely carried any expression or indication of public outrage. Now, frankly, I believe it killed and injured a heck of a lot more people. They just simply didn't cover it. 2,500 bombings in 18 months as the Vietnam War drew to a close. Yet terrorism was not considered a major public threat by the ruling class of the day. When they say public outrage, they mean media outrage. The press refused to depict any outrage because they were a part of it. Let's be clear here. The American media was never an objective news source. Writing a letter to the editor saying your reporting is biased towards the left is meaningless. That's like calling Gus Hall a communist. Well, no kidding. I mean, no one becomes a reporter just to report on things. It's always a backing agenda. One of the main pillars of leftist activism is the American press. And the other two, of course, are academia and corporate philanthropy. So you have three pillars holding up the leftist ideology. Without them, there would be no left. And Time Magazine, of course, is another leftist publication. The media are part of the leftist activist movement. Now, The Nation, which is explicitly a leftist magazine, they wonder why the terrorism of the 1960s and early 70s is ignored in American life. They're well aware of the answer. They know the answer. They're part of the answer. And they act as if they've no part in the organized cover-up. Reading books about the late 60s and early 70s, you read about all of these pacifist groups who somehow never condemned leftist violence. Now, of course, pacifism is largely a phony ideology. It's pure negation. Pacifism only comes into existence when the right wing is engaging in some kind of violence. Now, in this case, it was the government fighting in Vietnam. But the minute the left is doing the fighting, there's no pacifism. So pacifism exists only on strategic considerations. You had people calling themselves pacifists at the time who were attacking policemen. There were hundreds of police injuries. There were, thousands of injuries and civilians and deaths. Far more than the press would ever have you believe. Now, the anti-war movement that everyone knows from the 1960s U.S. have completely vanished. Now that Israel's wars are the main focus of American foreign policy. The U.S. military, as I've said many times, has gone from an officially hated group that saw hundreds of ROTC centers go up in flames to these overpaid deities overnight. The only thing that changed is that the enemy is no longer leftist. The enemy tends to be rightist, militaristic governments in the third world. When the war is against nationalism, there will be no anti-war movement. And the soldiers fighting could do no wrong. Magically, the anti-war movement has vanished. Despite this war lasting almost three decades with no specific purpose. The total lack of an anti-war movement since 1991 is extremely strong evidence that the movement in the 60s was a creation of the ruling class. We've had a war started in 1990-91 that's continuing to this very day. That's a long time. Far longer than Vietnam. Still, no anti-war movement to speak of. Now, in the early 70s and late 60s, the government, that is the American government, was fighting a war in Vietnam, but the ruling class was against it. Understand, I make a distinction here. The ruling class and government are two separate entities. It's pretty rare that the government and this ruling class are distinct, but it was certainly the case during Vietnam. Richard Nixon and Donald Trump are two examples of this phenomenon. And when you have a president that is at war with the ruling class, as Nixon most certainly was, as Trump most certainly was, suddenly the ruling class, either the press, the universities, whatever, will support and even finance leftist terrorist groups in response. But even finding information on the terrorism of the 1960s is hard. Actual hard data is very difficult to find. The veritable obsession with terrorism since at least 2001 has apparently not reached the 1960s. You would think it would. You would think it would spur research into domestic terrorism prior to this era, but it hasn't. The Third World Liberation Front, a group that even educated political scientists have never heard of, set off over 70 bombs between 1974 and 1978 on the West Coast. Again, no public outrage was ever registered. The Puerto Rican separatists killed hundreds of Americans, including many congressmen, and covered up terror campaign in the 70s and even into the 80s. In 1979, these people shot up a U.S. military, a Navy bus, killing four sailors. Despite making the front page of the New York Times, it was immediately forgotten. The article neglected to mention, of course, that the Puerto Ricans were being financed by Cuba. In 74, the SLA killed six in Los Angeles in connection with the Patty Hearst kidnapping. Still, no outrage. American cities burned every night, yet the left remained ascendant. No outrage, no Department of Homeland Security, no Patriot Act, no calls for gun control. Mainstream press, of course, downplays the number of those killed and wounded. They always claim only a handful died. Of course, it's far greater than that. The book Days of Rage, I'm quoting from this now. People have completely forgotten that in 1972, we had over 1,900 domestic bombings in the U.S., notes retired FBI agent Max Noel. He says, people don't want to listen to that. They can't believe it. One bombing now and everyone gets excited. In 72, it was every day buildings were getting bombed, policemen getting killed. It was commonplace. Well, it's not that people don't want to hear it. It's that they don't know. They've never been told. The press has done all it can to deny the existence either of these bombings entirely or their fatalities. The tiny handful of powerful media families were all anti-war and can easily be counted on to cover up the violence of the anti-war movement. I do not believe that these bombings didn't kill that many people. I think it's actually impossible that that be the case. The same people that were on the barricades in the 60s control the press and are, in fact, the ruling class today. The very phrase, a long march through the institutions, I know you've heard this before. It's kind of a Frankfurt School phrase that when the left failed to take over the government in the late 60s, and of course, when they were humiliated by Richard Nixon in 72, they said, well, the only thing we can do, since the population has rejected us, is to take over the other institutions. But using the phrase long march, that comes from the Chinese Civil War. The long march was how the communists were able to make war on Chiang Kai-shek. And of course, Mao Zedong murdered between 30 and 60 million Chinese without a peep of protest from the West. We're supposed to be all angry that the Iranians are building an atomic bomb, but the Chinese, who murdered 60 million people, exploded their first nuclear device in 1964. Not a peep from the West. The 60s crowd, which is where the boomer generation came of age. A boomer is someone who was born right after World War II. They refer to the baby boom of returning GIs, building their lives with the GI Bill and expanding economy, and having a lot of kids. So from 45 to Korea, I guess. And one of the central facts of the boomer generation is Vietnam. So it can't be much later than the 50s. Vietnam is when the boomer generation came of age, and it's what molded their political experience. They went from the barricades to the boardroom. One of the more absurd myths that have come down from this era, trying to make these violent terrorists look sympathetic, was Kent State. Kent State University in 1970s. The narrative, I remember this was one of the, in high school, I remember fighting with the teacher over the ridiculous narrative there. Now, many of you have seen the video. If you've seen Oliver Stone's film Nixon, the video is really bizarre. There were media there, they were filming it, and yet you will never see a full uninterrupted video of the process. Because it doesn't support the agenda. The guardsmen, the National Guard that was brought in, were very, very young. Now when you see the video in Stone's film or on YouTube, the guardsmen are depicted marching without any context. They could be going anywhere. Then they cut to a group of protesters yelling and screaming, also without context. Then the screen goes blank. Then shots are heard, which could come from anywhere. They could have, they weren't from the M1s that these guys had. Then it cuts to a dead body. So apparently the media filmed everything but the shooting, which of course is highly unlikely. They've spliced the film to avoid the actual truth of the matter. Despite the media narrative, the average age of the guardsmen was between 18 and 19 years old. The protesters were extremely violent, which is why the guard was there. The police couldn't handle them. What happened was that the guardsmen were backed up to a wrought iron fence that surrounded that part of the university. The protesters were going to kill them. We know that because they said so. Many eyewitnesses claimed that they were calling for blood. As this is going on, the ROTC center was in flames. Reluctantly, they were given the order to fire. Which, as we know, very few of these protesters were actual students. The press at the time said some of them were bikers and transients, although bikers were usually on the pro-war side. But what were these protesters doing? They were burning down the town. They burnt down the town and much of the university. So the mayor called the state of emergency. City officials and downtown businesses received very violent threats, and rumors spread that the city's water supply will be spiked with LSD. So by the time these kids arrived, much of the town and the campus was in flames. Amazing. No support the troops banners could be found anywhere, but the ROTC building was in flames, like so many of them were at the time. As fire trucks came to extinguish the flames, they cut the lines, which at that point means the protesters had forfeited their lives. Because at that point, they're sealing the deaths of anybody who was trapped inside. They forfeited their lives at that point. They burned down a city with all the injuries and deaths that caused. You now are a malignant tumor that calls for the harshest chemotherapy. Now, the mayor, of course, was not going to preside over the destruction of the town. And it need not be said that none of this was recorded in the press. And the editors were instructed that no context is ever offered. No context of any of these things is ever offered. It's presented as a random effect of violence. And the initial press, and I've actually seen these articles, I remember my father talking about them, that they just shot randomly at a group of students going to class. That's what people were told. The guard first used tear gas, but it was ineffective because it was windy that day. The so-called students were attacking the guard with rocks and everything, bats and knives and all kinds of makeshift weaponry, believing that they would never be punished. And they were allowed to indulge their most inhuman appetites, and yet the guard was expected to be absolutely stoic, completely double standard. Now, the head of the National Guard unit said that they were fired on first, which is very likely, because the student radicals were talking about killing him in any way possible. The ruling class probably did send someone to shoot to create an incident. The shooting was obviously justified and necessary, since they were backed up to a fence, which is why they will not show the video in its fullness. Now, 67 rounds were fired at close range, 80 feet. Since only 4 students were killed, allegedly, it couldn't have been a shoot-to-kill order. The geology professor who was there at the time, Glenn Frank, he went to the student leaders and pleaded with them. He said, "I don't care if you've never listened to anyone before in your lives. I'm begging you right now. If you don't disperse right now, they're going to move in and it can only be a slaughter. Please listen to me. I don't want to be a part of this." He's saying this over a bullhorn to these protesters. He's saying, you know, you are causing these guys to get scared. You're burning down the town. You're not protesting the war at all. You're revolutionaries. So Professor Frank is begging the students to settle down. And he wasn't the only one. A couple of guardsmen were injured by projectiles of various kinds. A few others had minor injuries. And that was right before the shooting order was given. Now, at the time, 1970, a Gallup poll showed that most Americans blamed the protesters, of course, who, after all, were burning down the town. But it was this, you know, it was this kind of reactionary opinion. Most Americans supported the war right into the 1970s. They supported Joe McCarthy. And this is why something like Kent State was necessary. It was to distract attention from the fact that these same people were killing people all over the country. The press at the time began running stories that an elite Marine unit attacked peaceful student protesters for no reason as they went to class. The ruling class financed many lawyers to bring these guys to civil and criminal trial, and they all failed. If soldiers in Vietnam weren't put on trial for killing VC, well, then why would guard units be tried for doing the same thing at home? The Viet Cong weren't burning every city in America. A far greater threat, of course, were these boomer kids. The students who were seen by police and guardsmen burning down the campus, of course, were all let off. All the cases against the guard were unsuccessful. Too many witnesses described the guard as frightened, with students closing in on them, screaming for blood. Right afterwards, the wrought iron fence was torn down to keep it from being used as a defense later on. Now you have writers like Miles Mathis, who's a good writer. He's an amateur journalist. He's hit or miss, but he has a few good papers out there. He claims that no one died that day, and the guard shot into the air. 67 shots at short range, and only 4 people were killed. Doesn't make a lot of sense. One of the so-called victims was William Knox Schroeder, who transferred in from Colorado, and he was part of a Marine counterinsurgency group. His father was a part of the military-industrial complex, as were the parents of Allison Krauss, who was kind of the girl, the darling of the event, whose picture is used in media reports to this day. And the picture is a fake. It looks nothing like the real Krauss, whose facial features are very distinctive. They needed her to build sympathy. So the incident had characters that they were able to invent. You know, the guard were the bad guys, protests were innocent. Allison was just an innocent victim. And of course, it's a creation of the media's imagination. Allison Krauss had no political opinions at all, as it turns out. No autopsy records of any of the victims have ever been released. Now, many of you have seen the famed picture of the woman screaming in front of the dead body there, which is on the cover of Life magazine, and it won a Pulitzer Prize. And it is a fake picture. It's said to have been taken minutes or even seconds after the shots were fired. Yet if you look at the people in the background, they're very relaxed. No one's running. No one's upset. No one's even looking at this girl screaming in front of this body. And there's no blood. The man was supposed to have been shot at the mouth at close range. And there's no blood. Another cover, the following week, or whenever it came out, was a picture of John Cleary, allegedly shot in the chest. Now, I've seen several pictures of him, and I have not seen a wound. I've seen no blood. I've seen no police. I've seen no first responders. There's an ambulance with the door open, but not a single paramedic to be found. Not in a single picture. And one of the absurdities, there was supposed to be, those of you who were around at the time, there was supposed to be a guy, I've seen pictures of him, who took a flag, a Viet Cong flag, and dipped it in this guy's blood. And then he jumped up and down on top of it in some weird ritual. Now, I've seen pictures of this guy jumping, and there's no blood that he's jumping into, for one thing. He's desecrating this guy's memory for some reason, not to mention destroying evidence at a crime scene. No one bothered to mention this. The guy depicted in the picture was never questioned. But in the picture of him, no students were even looking at him. There were shots fired seconds earlier, and students are depicted as milling around like waiting for a bus. A man is jumping up and down for reasons unknown in a pool of blood that was just released, and no one's looking at him. How likely is that? Why didn't no journalist mention it? It's another fake picture. Every weapon fired at Kent State was destroyed immediately after the event. Why would they do that? There was no debate of how many rounds were fired. There was no debate whether or not they fired. There was no debate who shot them. So why destroy them immediately? It would only make sense if the guard didn't fire them at all. Despite the fact that there were cameras rolling, there's no images or video of the shots themselves. And of course, no one asked these questions at the time. It doesn't take much to tear apart these ridiculous media stories. I grew up with them. I grew up with them being told to me in high school and college. And by the time I was 18, I was already questioning them because they don't make a lot of sense. The covers of Time magazine, the picture of the guy jumping up and down in the blood for some reason. No one questions this. And every one of these pictures, right after the shots were fired, students were milling around. They're not upset, they're not yelling, they're not running, they're not doing anything. These are fakes. What about the Black Panthers? This is a Jewish finance group. This was a group dedicated by their own explanation to the imposition of Maoist ideology on America. This doesn't bother anybody. They were financed by Leonard Bernstein, Bert Schneider, and Norman Mailer were their three big Jewish backers at the time. Let me quote from The Revolutionary Jew from E. Michael Jones. Not to be outdone by Brown, former NSCC chairman James Forman told the crowd, "We must serve notice on our oppressors that we as a people are not going to be frightened by the attempted assassination of our leaders. For my assassination, and I am a low man on the totem pole, I want 30 police stations blown up, one southern governor, two mayors, and 500 cops shot dead. And if Huey Newton is not set free and dies, the sky is the limit." The crowd responded by chanting, "The revolution has come, off the pig. Time to pick up the gun, off the pig." Martin Luther King was assassinated on the 4th of 1968. The long-awaited revolution arrived 2 days later when Cleaver ordered an armed attack on the Oakland police force. 4 carloads of armed Black Panthers set out to ambush the police on April 6th. When the police found them instead and attempted to pull them over, a gun battle ensued. As a result of the attack, Bobby Hutton, co-founder of the Panthers, ended up dead, and Aldrich Cleaver ended up back in jail. As had been the case with Newton, the Neo-Black Jewish Alliance quickly came to Cleaver's defense, claiming that he was a victim of an assassination attempt followed by a frame-up. In an open letter published by the New York Times, James Baldwin, Ossie Davis, Lilith Hardwick, Leroy Jones, Oscar Lewis, Norman Mailer, Floyd McKissick, Susan Sontag, said, "We find little fundamental difference between the assassin's bullet which killed Dr. King on April 4th and the police barrage which killed Bobby James Hutton 2 days later. Both were acts of racism." Now, here you have a group financed by the elite talking about killing hundreds of policemen. There was no call for a domestic terrorism unit. The phrase didn't even exist. No new executive department was created to deal with the problem. Newspapers promoting these views were not shut down. There were no calls for gun control. And Eldridge Cleaver, who converted later on, he said this. He said, "If people had listened to Huey Newton and me in the 1960s, there would have been a Holocaust in this country. Today, as we know, Black Panthers are politicians, university professors, treated as minor deities. The Panthers were using their elite funding to stockpile weapons. Still, when this was found out, no calls for gun control." Here's how the History Channel, which is absolutely absurd, it's a propaganda channel. This is how they describe the Panthers. This is their initial description. "The Black Panthers, also known as the Black Panther Party, was a political organization founded in 1966 by Huey Newton and Bobby Seale to challenge police brutality against African-American community." That's how they describe it. No mention of them calling for the slaughter of policemen. No mention of their dedication to Mao. No mention about the slaughter that Mao had just engaged in just a few years earlier in the Cultural Revolution. Again, the killing of Martin Luther King was necessary to set off the revolution. The ruling class was at war with the government. In 1968, of course, Richard Nixon had defeated Humphrey, which was really a vote of confidence in the war, or at least a belief that Nixon would slowly pull us out of it. But like everything else in American history, the murder of MLK is nonsensical. I'm quoting Miles Mathis here, and he wrote this in 2017. "After the alleged murder, James Earl Ray dumped his rifle and binoculars near the murder site without even bothering to bury them. He also didn't bother to wipe them down. He had his fingerprints all over them. He then pleaded guilty. This doesn't happen. It also conflicts with the prior story, since we're supposed to believe that Ray was so smart and clever to escape a maximum security penitentiary and avoid capture for almost a year, but not smart enough to wear gloves, wipe fingerprints, or hide a gun. One minute, he's a genius, the next minute, an imbecile." Even when you see pictures of Martin Luther King in his casket, I can make no sense out of it, because he was shot in the jaw, shot in the face, and it shattered his jaw, and the pictures of his casket show a totally untouched face. There's a famous picture of the guys on the balcony pointing, allegedly pointing to James Earl Ray. And it's even, it's just like the Kent State pictures. No one seems to notice them. No one's giving chase. No one is alarmed. There's men on the ground floor who are just milling around, completely having failed to notice the assassination and the perpetrator running off. Of course, as many of you know, the bullet that was found in MLK doesn't match James Earl Ray's rifle, which he just threw down there for some reason. Just like the frauds, whether it be Trayvon Martin or Rodney King, the point was to create a race war so that non-whites would win. Everything that the average educated American believes about the world is a lie. But the racial situation during the 1960s is absolutely inseparable from Vietnam itself, the anti-war movement, and the era as a whole. The 1960s ushered in what's called the Age of Aquarius. And there are several writers, E. Michael Jones in particular, who make the connection between the rites of the god Dionysus and the Earth cult, or the so-called hippie movement. I'm quite familiar with the Dionysian mythologic cycle. And he presented himself as a liberator, dancing to music in public places while intoxicated with the ritual of the Bacchae. No different from the New Left later on, millennia later. That these Bacchae were essentially private sex clubs. In other words, once sex is attached from human nature in the created order, it becomes recreation. And then, as E. Michael Jones has proven many times, it can easily be controlled from the outside. But drawing these parallels is fairly simple. Dionysian rituals, I mean, Dionysius himself was conceived in adultery. He was thrown out of his home and went outside Europe. He went to Asia to find a follower. And they were all female. Now, the Maenads and the Bacchae were two different groups of people. Then you had a young king, Pentheus, who was a virtuous young man, who, by the way, was Dionysius' cousin. He criticizes the women of the city for falling under his spell. But like a naive conservative today, he tries to use the power of the state to control it, which, of course, assumes that the women involved here are in a rational state of mind and capable of engaging in cost-benefit analysis. Pentheus says that the rites of the Bacchae exist to avoid the rigors of Greek morality, which, of course, is true. Dionysius called himself a liberator. Liberator from moral ties, liberator from the natural law. This debate existed at the time. Now, Dionysius is often called a god or a demigod. As I've said many times, the gods of the classical world weren't gods today. I mean, we refer to Yahweh or Allah. That is not how they're using the word God back then. These so-called deities were not all-powerful creators above matter. They were manifestations of stronger powers. Now, the Greeks, as you know, divided their pantheon between gods and titans. Titans were earthbound rulers. They were people. They were the ruler we still say the phrase titans of industry today. Giants, same thing. They're in the Old Testament, they're everywhere. Dionysius was a representative of the Titans, despite being fathered by Zeus. This is because Dionysius was a student of Chiron the Centaur, and hence a Titan. It was Chiron that was the author of the orgiastic rites of the Bacchae, not Dionysius. In other words, a demigod was corrupted by a powerful earthly ruler and promised earthly power in return. Now, he allows himself to be arrested, Dionysius does. And Pentheus, because he won't tell Pentheus the secret of the rites of the Bacchae that he is now fascinated by. And like everyone who's fighting immoral behavior, they're fascinated by it. In fact, a lot of them wish they could engage in this kind of behavior without consequences. Now, it's not hypocrisy. It's just, you know, everyone wants to engage their lower appetites once in a while. But of course, there are consequences to this. As is well known, of course, a herdsman arrives from the top of the mountain, Kithaeron, and he tells Pentheus that the Maenads were drunk and absolutely violent all around them. The line between sex and death is almost non-existent. Whether it be in the throes of lust or alcohol, one's behavior under the influence is usually regretted much later. But you can't deny the immediate pleasures they provide. And so there's a certain fascination for it, even when you're fully aware of its destruction and destructive power. You see, something that's very bizarre about the myth of Dionysus and the Maenads is that nothing can stop them. Sending the army against them was impossible. They defeated them all. And the reason that they could defeat armed force as women without armor is because it's so easy to appeal to that level of human nature. Jerry Rubin, Jewish head of the so-called Yippie movement, talks about sending naked women to the National Guard, saying if you desert, you'll have sex with you. It's almost like he read this myth and was acting it out. But the god himself, really the Titan, Dionysus, shows himself not to be out of control. The leaders of this movement, whether it be the Frankfurt School, Jerry Rubin, any of these guys, Tom Hayden, they were not out of control. Dionysus shows himself to be completely in control. He creates the frenzy of the Maenads, but he himself is not subject to it. It's the same thing for the riots of the 1960s. Usually the people who created these riots don't like that kind of behavior, but they found it useful because they didn't control the state. Rare though that is. King Pentheus represents today's the benighted conservatives, the idiots who think that getting the right people into Congress will eliminate the rot of Western society. But it doesn't take long for these guys to resent the pleasures that others have and even partake of it themselves. The connection between Dionysus and the Dionysian myth in the 1960s is well known. Once in a while I come across some idiot writing about Woodstock or Altamont as rebellions against conservative values. That's self-serving. It's a superficial understanding. Just like in the Dionysian myth, the dancing and the violence took place to music with all kinds of intoxicants. But they're not a rejection of conservative values or a ruling class. In fact, the creation of a ruling class. They're simply a blunt force instrument. They're the rejection of order as such. There is no end goal. Dionysus knew that the Maenads were a tool for his own power. He was simply using them. Altamont, Michael Jones talks about Altamont, was kind of the Woodstock of the West Coast, using the Hell's Angels as security guards. Now, this was a symbolic move. Hell's Angels, of course, representing demons. They weren't there for security purposes. They were there for ritual purposes. Both Grace Slick of Jefferson Airplane and Mick Jagger himself didn't seem to know what was going on in front of them. They couldn't figure out that the consequences of their Dionysian music were unfolding in front of their eyes. Jefferson Airplane used to talk about promoting anarchy, but the minute it actually broke out, they were screaming for the police. As Mick Jagger is flying off in the helicopter when all hell broke loose, he had a terrified look on his face, leaving his fans at the mercy of these guys. As the violence began, the Rolling Stones did the stupidest possible thing. They played Sympathy for the Devil. And Jagger says from the stage, something always happens when we play that song. Of course, as always, the press lied about it. And they did anything they could to remove the connection between the music and the dead bodies that were produced. Woodstock also saw bodies and loads of injuries. Rock concert deaths get a lot of promotion, but no one has put the two of them together. Aleister Crowley, most of you know of, justified and actually laid the groundwork for this bacchanalia in the early 20th century. Remember, modern rock, which created this, the music of the back, the modern back gang, is a creation of media conglomerates who had given themselves over to the Crowleyite mentality. As I've been saying for many decades, rock stars are media inventions. Their image is a creation of PR firms. It's regulated in their contracts. So, for example, when the Beatles arrived in the U.S. in 64, the world was told that they were met by mobs, mobs, and mobs of screaming teenagers, the first time that word was ever used. The national press was screaming that Beatlemania had besieged the country, and there's no stopping this juggernaut. And yet, the truth is that these kids were bussed in from a girls' school in the Bronx, and they were paid by the PR firms controlling the group. So many of the so-called riots in Beatlemania, even in London itself, were very close shots that if they were to draw back, showed only a handful of people. The Beatles were signed by EMI Records, which is, of course, one of the most important record labels in the rock world in the early years. EMI was run by Sir Joseph Lockwood, and it stands for Electrical and Mechanical Instruments. It was a weapons manufacturer who decided to have a music division. EMI was also part of the military intelligence establishment, since all weapons manufacturers have to be. August of 63, the famous so-called riot at the London Palladium, thousands of Beatles fans supposedly rioted. The next day, every mass circulation newspaper in Britain screamed that the police had to hold back thousands of teenagers. The closely cropped pictures, as I mentioned, were deliberate. Only 8 or 9 kids were involved. Then when they got back after their American tour, they were knighted by the Queen for their services to Great Britain. Both the Beatles and the Stones profited from fake news images and the ridiculous Ed Sullivan show. Sullivan, a man with no discernible talent whatsoever, permitted the Stones to destroy the stage in a pre-planned band riot. They were banned from the show, but of course, their records flew off the shelves. The intersection of international capital, the new rock scene in the 60s, and organized Satanism is easy to show. One of the key figures is Matt Anger. I'm sorry, Kenneth Anger. 66, 67, the Gnostic Process Church was recruiting among the elite in London, and Anger himself was recruiting the girlfriends of Mick Jagger and Keith Richard, Marianne Faithfull and Anita Pallenberg. Anger worked on a film dedicated to Crowley, which is called Lucifer Rising. And it was a nexus, really, of the Process Church, the Manson family cult, and the Rolling Stones. The music was composed by Mick Jagger himself. The Process Church follower, Marianne Faithfull, went all the way to Egypt to participate in the film's depiction of a black mass. The part of Lucifer in that film was played by Bobby Beausoleil, who's a member of the Manson family, was reputed to be Anger's homosexual lover, and of course, I believe is still in jail for the Tate murders. One of the group's friends says that Pallenberg was so obsessed with black magic, she began to carry a string of garlic with her everywhere, even to bed, to ward off vampires. She had a strange, mysterious old shaker for holy water, which she used in some of her rituals. Her ceremonies became increasingly secret, and she warned me never to interrupt her when she was working on a spell. This is a guy named Tony Sanchez, a fan of the group, and who knew everybody. 1980, 17-year-old caretaker of Keith Richards, New England estate, was found shot in Pallenberg's bed. Of course, ruled a suicide, which is laughable, as they all are. But it was with Pallenberg's gun. Richard's house was located near the East Coast headquarters of the Process Church. And of course, there's the Laurel Canyon phenomenon. One of the weirdest aspects of all of this. Dozens and dozens of major rock acts came out of this very small little area, starting in the mid-60s. The Byrds, David Crosby were the first two from the area. The Mamas and the Papas, Love, Frank Zappa, Buffalo Springfield, which included Neil Young and Stephen Sills. and the doors. What are the odds they all come from this one little area? Jim Morrison, as many of you know, the Lizard King, as he called himself. His father was Admiral George Stephen Morrison. Frank Zappa, the guitar genius. Zappa's father was a chemical warfare specialist assigned to Edward Arsenal. His manager, Herb Cohen, former U.S. Marine, was in the Congo in 1961, supplying Lumbaba communists with weapons. His first wife, Gail Slopeman, came from a long line of naval officers. John Phillips was one of the creators of the Haight-Ashbury phenomenon, and the 67 Summer of Love was the son of Marine Captain Andrew Phillips. And he was a part of the part of an elite military prep school in Washington, D.C. And he was appointed to the Naval Academy. I could go on. Stephen Sills of Buffalo Springfield. And then, of course, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Stephen Sills, no surprise, was a product of another military family. What are the odds? Stephen spent large chunks of his childhood in El Salvador, Costa Rica, alongside his military and intelligence father. David Crosby, too. Son of an Annapolis graduate, World War II military intelligence officer. Floyd Delafield Crosby. He spent most of his youth traveling the world. David Van Corlent, Van Schuyler, Van Rensselaer families. All are connected to these rock groups. Part of the Crosby family tree. You go through this Crosby family tree and you see senators and congressmen, assemblymen, governors, generals. Jackson Brown. Shockingly, yet too, the product of a military career family. Jerry Beckley, Dan Peek, Dewey Bunnell. Made all three, not well known, but they're all major songwriters of the era. Were all Laurel Canyon residents, all from military families. My God. Mike Nesmith of the Monkees. Corey Wells of Three Dog Night. All Laurel Canyon bands. All of them arrived in L.A. after a stint in the Air Force. Graham Parsons, who would briefly replace David Crosby in the Byrds before fronting the Burrito Brothers, was the son of Major Cecil Conner II, another military officer. Warren Zevon, James Taylor, endless. The list goes on. What are the odds? They're all from this little area. All from elite families, all from military families. And they had no reason to be there. At the time in the 60s, there was no substantial music industry in the area. There were no venues for pop music back then. The Beach Boys had only begun their rise. If you wanted to be a musician, you went to Nashville or Boston or New York, maybe Detroit. Not a tiny, almost deserted part of LA County. The weather underground, as we've mentioned before, who had, you know, absolutely no respect for human life. They bombed the U.S. Capitol building. They bombed the Pentagon, the National Guard building, the Bank of America, Golden Gate Park, Harvard University Center for International Affairs, MIT Research Center, Days of Rage riots in 1969, and helped Timothy Leary escape from prison. They were tightly connected to the ruling class at Laurel Canyon. Yet with all of this, no calls for national soul searching, no calls for gun control. CNN writes, during the decade of the 1970s, terrorists killed 200 people in the U.S. and injured more than 1,000 others. In the decade and a half since 9/11, terrorists have, by contrast, killed 74. The truth is, since 9/11, terrorists in the U.S. have killed zero people. But rather than recoil in horror, as they do for the invented terrorist acts on America these days, they lionized and almost deified the leaders of these terror organizations like the Black Panther. The Democratic Convention of 68 is lionized as a milestone in civil disobedience. Yet after 30 years of a no-win war in the Middle East, there is no anti-war movement in this country. protesters had announced during the days of rage. Then, of course, again, in 1971, the May Day protests in Washington, D.C., you had an organized movement of communists planning to overthrow the government. And it had grown to 100,000 people, and federal troops were called in to deal with them. Why does no one know about this? They announced that because the government had not stopped the Vietnam War, they would stop the government. So you had 100,000 people being bussed into D.C. to overthrow the state. No one's heard of this before. So the Jewish Yippie movement was engaging in hit-and-run tactics throughout the city, disrupting traffic and causing chaos. Politicians, of course, were harassed. And even federal employees held a Federal Employees for Peace rally in Lafayette Park and were not punished despite this being illegal. All throughout Georgetown that year, the police herded the protesters and onlookers through the streets of Georgetown University and engaged in back and forth with protesters, both with tear gas and with guns. Can you imagine if the right did anything like this today? There was no response to the leftist violence of 1971, even though you had an organized movement of 100,000 people descending on Washington, D.C. to literally overthrow the state, to the point where U.S. Army soldiers were brought in to confront them. This has been whitewashed from the history books. The ACLU then filed suit against anyone seeking to stop them. And of course, if they're mentioned at all, they're lionized as heroes and called civil rights activists. Books like Max Elbaum's Revolution in the Air, Alan J. Matsau, The Unraveling of America, Burroughs, The Bombings of America That We Forgot, which is from Time Magazine, Terrorism in the United States, B.M. Jenkins from 1980, Eric Alternum, Remembering Left-Wing Terrorism in the 1970s from The Nation. These are all the sources that you can go to concerning this stuff. The point I'm trying to make here is that despite this level of violence, despite open desires to overthrow the government and institute a communist dictatorship, despite Black Panthers calling for the deaths of thousands of cops, the extreme that every city in America was burned to the ground, soldiers were attacked on a regular basis. Terrorism was a day-to-day event. It wasn't a special thing. It's something you had to live with. No calls for gun control. No calls for a Department of Homeland Security. No hand-wringing over domestic terrorism. No shutting down of newspapers. No shutting down of magazines. And the reason is that the ruling class in America has always been, at least in the 20th century, a leftist movement. And since the government had now separated from the ruling class, especially under Nixon, or fighting a war in Vietnam that the ruling class had rejected. This doesn't happen very often. The wars in the Middle East, though, the ruling class has not only accepted, but supports and demanded. The same goes for a war with Russia or China or Iran. That's the difference. During Vietnam, of course, it was Marxism, allegedly, or communism that was under attack. That was unacceptable. Yet today, you have screaming headlines because some fat pig has a heart attack at Charlottesville. And yet that's, you know, what happened in Charlottesville is a weekend in the late 60s. Every American city was burnt to the ground, and the media lied about it, fully supporting and, in fact, working with the terrorists at the time. Every single thing that the American believes about this era is a lie, a carefully crafted lie, romanticizing terrorism and drug use, so long as the left is benefiting from it. The minute they perceive that the right is benefiting from it, all of a sudden you have calls for gun control, executive departments, the Patriot Act. Why do we get no Patriot Act after 2,000 bombings in just a few years? But when the enemy is right-wing religious governments overseas, rather than communist governments, now you have the ruling class on board, and soldiers are lionized beyond all merit. It's all a lie. So as our people are languishing in prison for things that would be nothing compared to what happened in the late 60s, rather than be in prison, those guys are university professors and congressmen and everything else. The press, the ruling class, is a leftist communist organization, period. They don't want to be objective, and calling them biased is meaningless. They know they are. They simply should be ignored. Anyway, thank you, my friends, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.